We have about an hour to delve into what on some level is a very technical set of texts about how courts are composed and pulled together in at least one aspect of Jewish law, but which I hope will be an illuminating vocabulary that we can take beyond these texts for thinking about what it is that we mean when we say we want to achieve justice and what kinds of systems are needed in order to make that a reality. I want to begin off the page by engaging this question and putting a few thoughts out there on the table. One of the things I think is most striking, I found it very striking in the aftermath of both Ferguson and the Eric Garner case here in New York, is what makes for a context where someone feels that something unjust has happened? What is it that gives us the instinct or helps us reach the conclusion, at least the preliminary conclusion, that we see some kind of conflict play out in our justice system, some sort of decision that's been rendered? In most cases, we are not actually directly involved in the data gathering, an eyewitness. We don't necessarily have firsthand accounts, but that doesn't necessarily preclude us feeling in a very deep way that we have a conviction that an injustice was done. And that, I actually think, bears some probing, which is, what is it that leads us to think that an injustice has been perpetrated? And by contrast, what would make us think that a verdict or a decision, which we might not necessarily agree with or think we might have arrived at, is nonetheless not unjust? What's the difference between a grand jury's failure to indict that leads people to feel something grave and horrendous has happened here that cuts to the core of rot in the system, as opposed to potentially being on the losing side of an election that you are upset about, but that you don't feel was a perversion of justice? So I want to actually begin by inviting us to throw that open for a minute. Perhaps for some of you very personally, it's a reflection on your own feelings about recent events and what made you engage with them that way. But it might also be at a remove, thinking about, in a second order way, what is it that might be a reasonable prompt or trigger for thinking about things not just as being an unfavorable outcome or something we didn't hope for, but something that's actually unjust. And by way of getting into that, I want to then look at a few texts that think about how Jewish courts are constituted with an eye towards some vision of what that is. So let's have a few opening thoughts here on what makes an outcome just, what are the ingredients that go into that, and conversely, what are the things that an outcome or a decision or an event lacks in the context, let's say, let's limit it to the justice system or the government or some kind of procedure that make it feel like it's gone off the path. Oh, a few thoughts to get us started here. What do people think? Please.
Well, in Ferguson, the members of the grand jury are under a gag order and can't talk. So when people think that a system's completely secret, we generally have great suspicion.
Okay, good. So transparency may be, if we put the flip side of what you're saying, transparency may be a key element of justice. And when that's missing, we don't know. In other words, you're imagining, perhaps, if that gag order were lifted, if all kinds of information came out, maybe people might feel differently about it, or maybe also the things that went wrong would be even more exposed, and it would be kind of overturned or dealt with in a different way. But the opaqueness of it is one factor. Okay, what else?
If one party is given leeway or benefit of the doubt in a way that the other party is not, there's a sense that, like, the thumb is on the scale. Justice and fairness seem to conflict there.
Okay, good. So some notion of imbalance there, almost independent of the outcome. The outcome itself is suspect if somehow the procedural ingredients feel like they are biased towards one side or the other. Okay, great. What else? Yeah.
Another reason that may lead us to believe something is unjust is our own personal knowledge or our belief about what has happened in the past.
All right, so it may not actually be about the local case. The local case may be an example of a broader pattern, which is really what we're focusing on, and that's the, whether it's the straw that breaks the camel's back or it's somehow the indicative public moment of something we're much more aware of, there may be a broader context. Great. Maybe one or two more thoughts here.
It seems that each human being has a built-in instinct of what injustice is. And to paraphrase that Supreme Court justice, it says, I can't define it, but I'll know when I see it. I'll know when I feel it. I know when I encounter it.
Good. So I think this is actually, in fact, my question, which is that I think is undeniably true and yet also unquestionably unhelpful on some deep level, because if we want to try to imagine how we emerge from those situations, we have to be able to finger what is it that caused us to go off here and what can bring us back on track. Great. One more comment. Yeah.
Well, I think the case you're describing in your hypothetical is extremely rare. I think about Bush versus Gore. I came across in studying it only one conservative who was troubled by the decision, and almost no liberals who thought it was fine. And I think the answer is that if you agree with it, you're basically okay with it, and if you don't, you don't, and you'll find a way to get around the legitimacy of the decision not to win.
Okay, so you want to say, really, the reality we live in, for the most part...
It's very rare. It's not that it never happens.
Yeah. But for the most part, it collapses my sense of what I want with my sense of justice. And actually creating an environment where people disagree, but nonetheless have some sense of sort of the fair rules of the game is rare, maybe increasingly rare. It's certainly, I think, one of the things that troubles us about our contemporary politics, where it feels like Bush v. Gore felt like one of those moments where we reached, at least in our own perception, a kind of new height of that kind of dynamic. Okay, good. These are all elements. There's more elements I think we could throw in. I think you've heard a number of things come out here as if we start thinking positively, what is it that produces just outcomes? There's some notion of transparency, access to information. There's some notion of there being a balance between the different forces. There's some notion of the fairness of the rules of the game. A key question that I want us to explore also as part of how we confront this, and it actually goes to the last comment about the difference between fighting for my side and fighting for some kind of just outcome, is the question, what you have here on the title of this source sheet, impartiality or advocacy. Because I actually think one of the places that potentially, but we'll see, maybe not necessarily, but potentially where the line gets drawn between the dynamics that lead to justice or injustice, so sometimes we think in this regard, is whether everyone is simply partisanly pushing for the outcome they prefer, or whether there is actually some notion of some impartial truth or just outcome that we can arrive at. Going back to what Rabbi Held was talking about in his introduction, the notion that there might actually be certain facts that you can confront that force you to acknowledge that something is problematic, irrespective of your position on what should be, irrespective of even your own perception of whether you're biased. I want to get into that question and these other issues by looking at a few, really one text in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which is from the 3rd century, 2nd century of the Common Era, and look at a whole slew of interpretations on it, which are essentially imagining what it is that makes a fair court. Now the context here, to just sort of get us into this, is the construction of a civil court in text from the 2nd century of Palestine in the Common Era. And the text here, I want to emphasize, is much more, it seems, a thought construction than something that was really a model that governed Jewish society. And that's in two cases, in two aspects. First aspect is the text, as you'll see right from the first words of this first text, refer to monetary cases, dinei mamonot. Monetary cases and not capital cases. Monetary cases merely disputes between people about property, but in no way actually cases that are dealing with the fundamental law and order questions of society. Now, that is the case for two reasons. One, capital law in Jewish thought internally is intended to be a fundamentally frustrating and unsuccessful endeavor for the prosecutor. The whole internal hardwiring of capital law in Jewish law is essentially to almost guarantee that there will never be a conviction. And therefore, it is profoundly unhelpful for figuring out how it applies to a society that actually needs to rely on some kind of capital court system in order to police and control and help its society thrive. That interplays with the other factor, which is important to know about these texts, which is Jews as Jews, maybe as Israelites, the story was slightly different, but as Jews in the Second Temple period and beyond, never really had custody of capital law, certainly once the Roman Empire entered into the picture, where this simply was not delegated to the Jewish community to be in charge. And so therefore, the most actual live examples in any way we have of Jews trying to think about fairness and justice relate for the most part to monetary cases in which they did have some degree of autonomy, particularly in constructing courts like the one we'll see in a minute, which seem to lie somewhere between a standing justice system and ad hoc arbitration panels that are intended to get people to resolve local disputes. In the context of that, the Mishnah says as follows. Monetary cases are conducted in a court of three. So you have a panel of three that adjudicates that kind of case. And now we get two views as to how this happened. This one chooses one, and this one chooses one, and both of them choose another one, according to Rabbi Meir. I've translated this very literally from the Hebrew, so you get a sense of some of the ambiguity here. It perhaps becomes clear when we see the second line. The sages say the two judges choose another one. Okay, what are the opinions here? What are we talking about? We're talking about constructing a court of three. Rabbi Meir's position seems to be this one, meaning one of the litigants, chooses one of the judges on the panel. Another one of the litigants chooses another one of the judges on the panel. And then the two of them, meaning both litigants, somehow agree and choose the third judge. Okay, so the panel here, really much more like what we would think of as an arbitration panel, is formed, but nonetheless a panel that will have real power to execute a judgment, is formed through two acts of unilateral selection, followed by an act of some kind of collaborative selection. The sages offer a different model. They say instead, judge one is chosen by litigant one, judge two is chosen by litigant two, but judge three is chosen by the other two judges that have already been selected. What do you think this debate is about? What's the basis of the dispute between Rabbi Meir and the sages with respect to the third judge's selection, which is all that they seem to disagree about?
Yeah. Maybe the sages just think that it's practically impossible for the two parties to actually agree on a third judge.
Okay, great. So one notion may be we can't have... The whole point is these people are in a dispute. There's no way they're going to agree on anything. The best you can do is balance out the power as far as you can take it, but since you can't have a panel of two judges, because what if there's a split verdict? For the third one, you'll have to rely on people who actually have one step removed from the other side. And in that sense, it might be a very practical concern. In other words, this may not be about some theory of justice. This may be about how are you actually going to get this panel together. And the sages essentially think Rabbi Meir is unrealistic. Okay, good. What else? What else do you think might be at stake here in this debate? Yeah, please.
The level of expertise. So the judges might have different qualifications for what they're looking for in the third judge.
Okay, good. So perhaps the people that are going to be selected by the litigants will be, I know, a little lower down on the ladder of qualification, maybe in some way, because they're only being chosen through the partisan interest, perhaps, of the different sides. And the third judge, already by having that removed, maybe you'll get someone who has sort of more perspective, more qualification in a way that would otherwise be impossible. And why would that be better? Why are qualifications better for judging a case?
More experience, could be more, also less partial.
Okay, so I think, right, it's implicitly what you're saying, but I want to draw it out, would be the notion that someone with more experience or perhaps with more seniority would be more likely to have also some degree perhaps of impartiality. in a way that we worry about it being anchored just in the litigants' preferences. That's obviously another way of reading the debate between Rabbi Meir and the sages here. If we wanted to really push that in a more intense way, we would say, well, Rabbi Meir actually thinks the way you construct a court that will actually ensure the most just outcome is to have the judges as tied to the litigants as possible. And therefore, no judge should be on that panel who is completely disconnected from the people who are litigating the case. Whereas the sages might have a different view and say, actually, no, we don't necessarily want a panel of all three being simply selected by some amorphous power, but we do want there to be at least a voice there who is not somehow beholden to the two sides. That's going to be the question later interpreters are going to try to ferret out here. What is behind both the debate between Rabbi Meir and the sages, but also when you think about the whole system here, kind of surprising to us when we think about our own court systems, of selecting the judge? Right, and everyone seems to agree on that. What is that about? Okay, so that's the sort of opening text that we're now going to see various expansions on to get to these various questions. All right, so let's start with a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi. So this is now one of the interpretations on the Mishnah. We're dealing here with a text also from the land of Israel, from Palestine, but now from a sage about 100 years, 150 years later than the Mishnah. And he says something very simple and straightforward. Said Rabbi Zera, since he chose him, he pursues arguments in his favor. Mitoch shebererro miradef zechuto in the original. What do you think that means? Since he chose him, he pursues arguments in his favor. And this presumably is a positive aspect of this.
In fact, in our terms, the judge chosen by the litigant is really acting like a lawyer in our terms.
Okay, good. And why would that be good?
Maybe
it's not good, but let's presume this is saying the reason we're doing this is because of this. So why is that good?
In other words, it only will be strengthening the argument of the litigant.
Okay, and just to push you one more step, and why is that good? Isn't that going to lead maybe to some, you know, imbalanced outcome?
Well, you're going to have both sides of it. It's like two lawyers, in effect, and then you have the third judge being as a judge in our sense.
Good, nice. So some people are actually going to come and talk about that with the dynamic of the third judge.
Yeah.
But let's just begin with the first one on each side. Yeah. I think what you're beginning to articulate here is probably, it's a very obscure statement, but part of what Rabbi Zera here is probably getting at, even if you look at his language, on account of choosing him, he chases after the arguments in his favor or his merit.
Yeah.
I think Rabbi Zera is saying there is always a fear and always a danger in any justice system that the case in favor of one side will be abandoned, will be neglected, will be overlooked. You will have a judge who is not connected to the trials and travails of that litigant, and they'll only be concerned that they've done some kind of procedural due process, which is enough to check off the box of not being negligent or malpracticing, but they will not feel invested to pursue every avenue for the exoneration of, or in this case, the vindication of the litigant. And Rabbi Zera seems to be hinting that actually we want some element of the justice process to include someone who is actually much like a lawyer in our system pursuing the rights or the case of one of the sides. Yeah.
It might indicate that one of the meta values is a drive towards as much acquittal as possible.
Yes. Now here, just remember, this is a monetary context and not a capital one. So acquittal is not really going to be the right term. Here it's going to be some money is coming out of someone's pocket and going into someone else's pocket. Even though the language of zechut here, of merit in a capital context, would mean exoneration or acquittal. But there's some notion of there is a passion that is apparently needed to make sure that at least arguments in favor have not gone unexplored. In some ways, you could say that's even more striking that it's a monetary case, which is to say all the more so would we think that in a capital case. But Rabbi Zera seems to even think that's important when just money is at stake. Okay, yeah.
It could also be, when it says argument, it could be collective arguments. In other words, like, maybe it's a reflection of the fact that less of something like you want to vote for, and therefore you need two different judges to pursue the approaches to cause us or to justify one side or another.
Okay, so you could read this, I think you're, that's interesting what you're doing, you're almost reading this in a way of, in order to get at the right potential outcome here, we have to be aware that there could be lots of different potential outcomes, and so we need some kind of advocate that can explore all of them. Maybe it shouldn't be read as overly tied to pursuing what's in favor of the litigant, it's just in order to get at the right halachic Jewish legal context for the final decision, each side needs to sort of pursue it from their own side. We'll see, I think, some texts that push it in that direction. That's a different kind of angle on reading. Yeah, please.
I only agree that from the text, you would read the tendency for acquittal, because even the prosecutorial process is judged. So I think it's that both sides, regardless of their stance, want.
Right, so I think that's right here. And really, it's not so much the... It's not the prosecutorial side, but it's the plaintiff side, right? The plaintiff side here is also picking a judge, and this text, I think, does seem to, in a balanced way, indicate we want someone chosen by each side that will fight hard for that side in their case. All right, let's look at a contrast here now. If we go to the Babylonian Talmud, let's hold your comment for 1 second, and we'll fold it back in, okay? Let's look now, if we jump to, this is a great example of the same tradition in the name of the same sage reported in both Talmuds, one in the land of Israel and one in Babylonia, but the tradition gets reworked with a completely different language in the Babylonian text, which I think, though you'll judge, indicates a very different kind of processing of what this system is about. So here in the Babylonian Talmud, someone want to read this? Talmud Bavli, Sanhedrin 23a. You're going to see a very different tradition in the name of Rabbi Zera. I can read this in the English. Volunteer? Please.
Why do they specifically do it this way? They say in the West, in the name of Rabbi Zera, as a result of this one choosing a judge for himself, and this one choosing a judge for himself, and both of them choosing another one, the judgment will emerge.
Okay, we have to analyze actually the question and the frame here, but already you see the language is totally different. Rabbi Zera in the land of Israel is about saying he will pursue the advantages of each side in an aggressive way. Here in this Babylonian text, it's Yetze Hadin La'amito, the judgment will emerge in its true form. Some, at least rhetorical appeal to the notion of there being a potentially true judgment and a potentially false judgment, and what we are after is the right outcome. Okay? Very different frame. But now let's try to dig into this text of what is it that produces this. So there's actually two things that are unclear here. One is, when the Talmud says, why do they specifically do it this way, what does it mean? What is it referring to? Which aspect of the selection process is it talking about? That's question one. Question two, which is a sub-question of that, is it explaining Rabbi Meir's position? Or is it explaining the sage's position? Or is it explaining something common to them both? Put in very concrete terms. Is this a question that wonders, why do the litigants get a unilateral selection of the first two judges at all? Is this a question that wonders why Rabbi Meir thinks the third judge must also be selected by the litigants, but in tandem? Or is this a question, why did the sages require that the third judge be a kind of removed selection of the first two judges rather than of the litigants? Okay? What do you think? What do you think is the question here, and how does the answer answer? Whatever the answer is, it imagines that the feature we're focusing on somehow leads to a truer verdict. Not just to the, you know, sort of balance of both sides, but there's a truer verdict. What do you think? Which piece is being analyzed here? Which piece of the Mishnah? Yeah. Sorry, Rachel. Yeah, Elaine.
So I guess sort of bias in reading it is that I think it's his explanation that there's this judge who's at more of a remove, because if you're reading it as like both plaintiff or both litigants being able to pick one judge, that would seem to imply that the true verdict is just sort of in between somewhere, which we know isn't always the case. And it's this idea of having someone who is removed from the specific interests of each party that's able to sort of have that perspective to render a case.
Okay, good. So if we read Din Emet here, Din La'amito, the true judgment, as you're reading it, which is the notion of a kind of almost more Platonic, more removed, pure, true, accurate judgment. That is actually the way the Tosafot here on the bottom of the page in 12th, 13th century France, the way they read this, they said, what does it mean, true judgment in its true form? It means it excludes a judgment that technically followed all the procedures, but is so clearly and obviously wrong. Right? There's actually other interesting texts in the Talmud that say if a judge sees that the witnesses that came forward are lying, in the sense that he can just tell they're lying, even though he has no procedural basis for throwing out their testimony, he's obligated to throw out the case, okay? Because there's some notion here, it goes back to that intuition, right? We have some kind of intuition of when something's unjust. The Din Emet here is about getting to some notion of fairness that goes beyond to, we had a fair process and everyone had buy-in and they all were a part of it. If that's the way we read it, then one very coherent way of reading the Talmud here is, the feature we're focusing on is the sage's opinion that the third judge has some kind of impartiality. And the reason that we demand that, answers the Talmud, is that's the way you'll get a true judgment. And in fact, this line would then be read as, the problem with Rabbi Meir's position is it will never escape the clutches of partisanship. Because even if we somehow get to the place where those two people cannot agree on the third judge, it will have been so dirtied by the political process of selection. You know, think about jury selection and the preemptive strikes and the ways in which people finally find, you know, will agree on this group. The notion that that doesn't necessarily produce a kind of removed justice that you want is certainly one way of reading it. Good. What else? Yeah.
You can also read it the other way, because the wording that the Bible is using actually reminds us of Rabbi Meir's opinion. I mean, they're using the same
Okay, so linguistically, actually the quote that they use is the first line in the Mishnah as attributed to Rabbi Meir, meaning the phrase is, and the two of them, right? Both of them choose another one, as opposed to the two judges choose another one. So that opens the possibility that actually the Talmud is focused on Rabbi Meir, and now play it out conceptually one more level. How does, what aspect of Rabbi Meir brings this?
Saying that it's actually, the justice system is actually trying to advocate for one of the sides. So justice could come only when you actually are non-impartial, when you have some connection to the case.
Okay, good. Maybe the impartial judge is actually part of the problem. And at least when they're trying to explain Rabbi Meir's theory, you could read the Talmud here as saying, the way you get to a true judgment is by making sure that everyone on the panel is somehow rooted in the interests in the case. Now, at the end of the day, there's competing interests, so you'll have to balance them. That's third judge. You're going to have to find a way that they agree. But you don't want someone who is detached in that kind of a way. And let me just ask you one follow-up question. Do you then understand, what is the truth of the judgment then in this reading, nonetheless, that you will get to kind of the right Platonic ideal thing, or? So spell it out.
I think it's just that you want someone that's indifferent, because if the judge doesn't care, then they might kind of just say, okay, whatever, I'll take this standard or the other one. But that's not what you want. There is no Platonic truth.
Okay, so let's actually just, you know, explore that last line that you said. I think this is actually very important, right? What you begin to realize may be at stake here is that there could be two totally different understandings, going back to my initial question of what is justice? What does it mean to achieve justice? One version of it perhaps may be there's a right outcome out there. True, only God could really get at that. But human beings have to do their best to get to it, right? Think about the notion of there being a news and not just an editorial section of papers, right, of journalism. The idea that actually, no, I could express opinions, but there is, I'm actually trying, yeah, I'll have this bias, that bias, but I'm trying to give people some kind of take on what actually happened, the actual facts. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about justice is everyone buys in to the end result, right? Think about it much more like arbitration, where actually maybe there is no such thing as a platonic just outcome. Maybe even to the extent that exists, it is up there in some platonic form that can never come down to earth. And that is not the role of human courts, to try to approximate that. In that sense, perhaps the collapse of politics and a certain kind of adjudication maybe is not even all that bad. Maybe that's, at the end of the day, what we're shooting for. All right, that's a very different way of reading the Talmudic passage here. Actually, it's about Rabbi Meir, and specifically about the feature of there being no judge who is not in some way selected by the litigants. Okay? Now, obviously, the other reading here is potentially focused on both of their views, which is the notion that there's a unilateral selection at all. And they're not focused on the third judge. They're focused on the first two. And they're remarking there on the idea that, in fact, the litigants need some kind of buy-in. We'll see that played out now in a couple of later interpretations. Okay, a few comments at this point, and then we'll move on to our next phase. Yeah.
A tangential thought. It strikes me the degree to which this discussion about how to select judges exists in the headlines. Because so many jurisdictions, there's vigorous debate about whether judges should be elected, popular elections, chosen by the Bar Association, chosen by the legislature, chosen by their peers. This is going on today.
Correct. That's good. Thank you for making a connection. I agree. I think this is 100% a part. Look, it's hardwired already into much of our political process of how we select justice. Some of it goes back to federal constitution and state constitutions, but then also where there's still leeway or still debate. You know, how grand juries function and are selected, et cetera, et cetera. This is all a piece of getting at this. And unless we have some notion of what are we even shooting for, like what's the end goal here, I don't think we can have a sense of did it go justly or unjustly. Please.
It seems like, yeah, the tension that seems to be has to do with, seems like it has to do with conflict resolution at the time versus like some larger sense of justice. And the only reason, and conflict resolution sounds great, the only reason to pursue that kind of larger sense of justice that the third judge supposedly can represent is just for precedent and, like, to continue on this road and keep, and because it's not just this case, it's going to be the future of all cases. So it seems like that's, like, a really big question and a really big reason to pursue this, what seems like kind of a, not, like, a sense of a justice that's kind of harsh and can be procedural but not represent the intuition or the conflict resolution that is like the origins of trying what we're trying to do there.
So that's the flip side of right how these individual cases may aggravate us because they're part of a larger pattern in the society. The cases ideally in some way maybe are intended to establish some kind of precedent so that there's some pathway going forward. Of course, the more then there's a feeling of illegitimacy around the status of the court or its decision, the more that may actually undermine itself, because the very thing that's supposed to be about the stability of the framework here will end up making it vulnerable. Great. Okay, a few other comments. Yes, please.
It's out of context, so I'm not sure, but I was wondering whether Zara's comment could be about the third judge. Could we sort of interpret the thing, he chose him, meaning he chose his single advocate, and then they eventually something's going to happen with the third judge. But I was wondering if it's talking about, you know, it's all very well to have one advocate on your court, but in a court of three, you need at least two. Because otherwise, you know, if the third person doesn't hear your argument, doesn't understand your case, then you don't have a chance. So I was wondering whether Zera is saying, well, you need both people to have an investment in the third judge in order to know that whatever judgment the full panel comes to, they have the full panel of the original case. Because you can believe that if the judge that you chose went against you, then you can accept the judgment. Because, you know, even the person I had an investment in, he pursued the arguments in my favor, but nonetheless he came out against me.
Okay. You have almost verbatim, I think, said part of Rashi, which we're going to look at in 1 minute. But I want to just understand what you're saying, because I thought I detected a shift there in the middle. This is to assuage the concerns of the litigant as you were reading it, or of the first two judges that they selected the third? That's a piece I didn't
know. I mean, if he's talking about the litigant,
yeah.
Then so he's looking at A or B, whichever judgment it is, both of them need to know the full judgment was by someone or by a group of people, all of whom, or at least two of them, a majority of whom they had an investment in, and a majority of whom did pursue the arguments in their favor, whichever way they can.
Good. Okay, so you're going to see that in nice medieval rabbinic Hebrew in just a moment. Okay? Great. Two more comments from folks who haven't yet spoken. Yes.
So, basically, I know we're throwing around two different terms to injustice, but before we're talking about whether there could possibly even be some sort of open common truth, but I would argue that truth and justice are mutually extricable, so that when you're dealing with cases like this, you're often caught in reaching this truth, but perhaps there are multiple truths which are informed by our instincts, and that goes back to what we're talking about in the election and that type of direct reaction and how everything's sort of folded in together. So in that sense, in my mind, justice is separated from this sort of biased sense, I guess. But that in which you can reach a case of a platonic sense of just resolution. But there's no way to sort of narrow it down to one truth.
Okay, so I think what you're just articulating is exactly what I'm trying to push us to explore here, which is that justice, I think, is actually a very plastic term that can mean very different things to different people. And you're articulating one piece of that, which now we're going to see kind of robustly articulated. But it can mean these very different things. And that's okay if we're conscious of what we mean when we're using it. Okay? Great. Last comment on this.
Follow up. If indeed truth was our sole objective, then all we would need is a single judge who knew Torah and could achieve a Torah truth judgment.
Good. So you could say, particularly for Rabbi Meir's position, once he's willing to have, he imagines that it's possible for the two litigants to agree on a shared judge. Right? So why not just have them agree on one? Right? And that'll be enough.
Look at our society with a similar case. That's what we have.
What you got?
Correct. But you have the lawyers. Right? And that's what's interesting.
Select the judge.
Correct.
I know you refer to arbitration, but this is more like litigation.
Correct. And it's sitting, I think, somewhere in between. Okay, good. I'm going to ask you, I'll hold your comments. I want to now see this played out, because a lot of the ideas that have come up now, you'll see in some various later interpretations. So this now, as the title here indicates, right, this is later interpreters of the Talmud trying to understand what is it exactly that makes this system good? Looking at the data of the Mishnah and filtering it through often the language of Rabbi Zeira as reported in the Babylonian Talmud, what are the alternatives that we are not following and why are we choosing this path? What is good about it? Okay? So let's start with Rashi. Zach, do you want to read that, since I think you articulated much of this? And you can give it to us in his language.
True judgment will emerge in its true form, because the litigants will obey the decision. For the one who lost will think, I myself chose one of the judges. He could have found a way to vindicate me, he would have. And the judges themselves are naturally inclined to try to vindicate the respective litigants, for both litigants chosen.
Okay. Rashi actually says two things here, which is interesting here. The first piece is straight up, directly, what will make for a true judgment that people will accept it. The tzaitei ba'alei dinin. The people will obey it. Emet here, as Rashi reads it, the word truth, not in the sense of some truth in another realm that is objectively correct, but true in the sense that, like emet v'yatziv, it will be stable. It will last. There will not be rioting in the streets in the wake of it. There will actually be a sense of well, maybe I don't like how this turned out, but I accept it. And what leads to that? What does Rashi understand to be the feature that enables that to happen? What does he say?
Being convinced that both of the judges have your interests.
Yeah, at this point of the convinced and the perception will be important later. In other words, did it really happen, or is it just that you have the perception that it happened? But let's just focus on what he says for now. What is critical, says Rashi, for a verdict to actually have some stability to it, is that each side feels that actually their interests were represented. If you do not have that, impossible. You will never achieve a true verdict. And this almost sounds like reading the version of Rabbi Zeira in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Talmud of the Land of Israel, into the articulation in the Babylonian Talmud. Meaning, what's a true verdict? A true verdict is one where the various sides pursue the arguments of the litigants who chose them, and that will lead the litigants to feel that they were in fact represented. Someone was representing them, and therefore they will then accept it, because they will not feel that they were backed into a corner or sort of disempowered to accept something that did not fundamentally take them into account. And then a second point, which is interesting, what does he say about the judges? Why is this system better for the judges as well? Or better for the outcome? Somehow, if the judges are chosen by the litigants, the judges will be motivated to find arguments in their favor. Not clear from Rashi's language alone why is that such a benefit, but it goes back to our discussion of Rabbi Zeira and the Talmud Yerushalmi. Either it's because you'll be more likely to get to a correct outcome in some way, and this is a kind of balanced approach here in this long comment of Rashi, or the notion here is that actually, by setting up a dynamic where the judges will pursue the interests of the litigants, that will be part of making the litigants feel that they were represented. Right? But Rashi clearly has some notion here. The feature he's explaining is the selection of the litigants, the involvement of the litigants in selecting the judges. If you will, their involvement through the political process here in a very small way of feeling they're invested in how the system was created. That is the key element that we need to focus on, and that's what leads to some kind of truth, which has some kind of grounding in the acceptance and legitimacy of the verdict. Okay? That's one way of thinking about what this text is talking about. Yeah?
I was thinking perhaps there's also an element of the judges themselves recognizing that the decision is true. There was like, if they're pursuing each other, the different positions, then obviously they recognize that they're, to some extent, being contentious. But the third judge, like, they themselves have to understand that this could be true amongst themselves.
So therefore?
Therefore, the decision is not just from the perspective of the litigants, but also expected from the position of the judges themselves, and also vice the justice system as a whole.
Meaning the justices or the judges themselves will not feel that they themselves were just partisan hacks?
Yeah.
Okay, good. There'll be something about that balance that will enable them also to respect and stand behind their verdict. Okay, great. That's another way of reading his focus in the second clause there. Yeah.
I'm also reading the second part, some sense that the judges feel that so that the judges will be more accountable by the fact that they were chosen, which I think is very counter to the contemporary justice system is set up. And again, I'm very curious what that means, what that means that the judges are more accountable than the fact that they were chosen.
Good. What's potentially troubling about it to you?
I'm not sure. But it's very curious.
Yeah, it's a very different way of thinking about it. You want to jump in on that question?
I mean, just this whole time I'm not learned enough in Jewish law to know whether this is a factor or not. But in my sort of Western training, I'm caught on the idea of subjectivity and objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And before, when we were talking about
that's a lot of text flying around.
The Babylonian.
Babylonian Talmud, yeah, the Talmud Bavli, yes.
Right. I mean, that was Gamze the Gamze. That was both seem to be, to me, seem to be at issue, right? Because the
that the first two, the ones chosen by the litigants, they are sort of more subjective because they're from, you know, they're, at least that's what they're saying, is that that they'll be looking out for the interests of the litigants who chose them. And then the third one, chosen by the two of them, supposedly is more objective. And I think in the West, in our system, we try for complete objectivity, which is not consistent with where this is coming from. And I don't know. I'm struggling with that as I think about. And I think that the truth emerges, I think, here from this tradition, from both being at issue at the same time. For the panel to have both a subjective source and an objective assumption.
Right, good. I would say, just to affirm but also problematize the description of who has what kind of system, I think we actually have quite a mix in the United States in the sense that the federal judiciary is very much built on some notion of a certain kind of remove and objectivity and life tenure and all those kinds of things.
Right.
Obviously, in many state and other jurisdictions, judges are elected. To say nothing of the prosecutorial system and how much that interacts with electoral politics, etc.,
right.
Such that I think we have a mix in some ways, like this text is grappling with a mix. And then exactly what your point is, where and why are we pushing some kind of model that is imagining and pursuing some kind of objectivity? And where are we not? Are we doing that coherently, thoughtfully? What are the goals at stake? Great.
And of course, the grand jury, you know, thing, that the elephant in our room here is this whole prosecutor controlling the grand jury seems to, you know, rub many of us the wrong way.
Right. Okay. Great. Great. Couple other comments. Yeah.
Is there something that we can learn from the fact that this is monetary issues? The nature of monetary issues is almost always that there is truth on both sides. The nature of the Imam Anot is that the resolution can always be resolved to address both issues in common. So maybe what's being addressed here, and the ultimate truth, of course, is, as with many things found in baseball, we have something called baseball arbitration. And you said in the beginning that really what's happening here is that you have an arbitration right where two advocate judges are being appointed, and either they or the litigants appoint the third. The third in some ways becomes, I guess, the decisive. And also an advocate for something that would address both concerns. So is truth here supposed to refer to the position of A or the position of B? Or is truth supposed to be some plastic synthesis that addresses both?
Yeah, the question when you ask, can civil cases always sort of be, monetary cases, be summed up as there's truth on both sides and it's about finding the middle path, it a little bit depends whether there's any kind of deception in the mix, right? To the extent that one side is in any way being duplicitous, it may not be that that's the case at all. To the extent that there's a sort of well-intentioned dispute and misunderstanding, that's probably right. But I think one of the things that is difficult, certainly in a lot of the way that a lot of monetary cases come up in the Talmud, is there's a notion of, I don't really have witnesses, right? Or I don't have a solid set of witnesses. And there's some kind of, you know, he said, she said, she said kind of situation. The judges have to do their best with some kind of circumstantial testimony to arrive at some conclusion. And at the end of the day, there's also going to be default presumptions of, right, the principle of Hamotzi Mechavero Alav HaReaya, the rabbinic principle, which is, in general, you don't take money out of someone's pocket and give it to someone else unless you have solid proof, of course, always means that there's someone who wields more power in the case than the other. The plaintiff in that sense is always disadvantaged because they have to actually prove to some standard that something happened. So I think it depends on the kind of the case. And what I said at the beginning, for sure, is, look, a lot of the cases that are driving us to have these kinds of discussions in this symposium in contemporary America are not monetary cases, right? And in that sense, there's some degree of the limited analogy at work here. But again, I think the dynamics, and here we see Rashi, I think, articulating one, the dynamics of what it takes for an outsider, or in this case, one of the litigants, to feel that something fair has happened, that I'm trying to suggest is perhaps a little bit more universalized. I want to look in our remaining time just briefly at three texts that play this out more fully. Turn to the next page. The first is a passage from Rav Yosef Halevi Ibn Migash from 12th century Spain. And he gives, I think, a good articulation of what the role of advocacy might be in actually pursuing the outcome. So we're on the top of page 3 here. I'm sorry, the page numbers aren't on the bottom. Someone want to volunteer to read this one? Why should I do it this way? He has a slightly different text of the Talmud, not why is it done this way, but why should I do it this way? Someone want to take this? Read us through. Yeah, please.
Why should I do it this way? From Yosef Ibn Migash. In other words, why did they say that one litigant picked one judge even without his friend's consent, and the other litigant picked one judge even without his friend's consent? The result is that only the third judge is selected with the consent of both of them. Why don't we force both litigants to agree on all three judges?
Okay, let's just clarify. What his question is on whose position? Rabbi Meir or the sages? Rabbi Meir, right? Because Rabbi Meir, at the end of the day, he says, imagines that you do force the litigants to agree on judge three. So why wouldn't you force them to agree on the whole panel? Why would you have this unilateral selection? I got to pick this, and you don't get to say anything about it. Why would you do that? Go ahead.
We answer, as a result of this one choosing a judge for himself and this one choosing a judge for himself, and both of them choosing another one, the judgment will emerge in its true form. Meaning, each judge will vigilantly search for arguments favorable to the litigant who chose them, and each one of them will be punctilious to defeat the arguments of the other. And then the third judge will balance them. Since he was selected by both litigants, he is not biased towards one side or the other. Therefore, he will listen to detailed arguments of both sides and get to the depth of the matter, and the judgment will emerge in its true form. Were all three chosen by both litigants, none would incline to vindicate either side, and they would not be so exacting in their analysis.
Okay, so this is very interesting, right? This really, on some level, lays out what I think we think of as the advantages of a two-advocate combined with a judge system. You need someone who you feel, not just they're connected to you, but they are exclusively in your corner or exclusively emerging from your preference. And here, though, the interesting thing is that focus is not, contra Rashi, is not about you will accept the outcome. It may also be at stake. But actually, you will not pursue all of the arguments. Okay, right? In other words, is the best, you can ask this, I used the analogy of journalism earlier, right? Is the best journalism done by someone who actually doesn't really have any stake or background and just shows up and tries to learn? Or maybe you could argue the best journalism is done by someone who deeply cares about what's going on and has an opinion and is going to look for every single thing that they can, right? And that's why there's any number of people who, the way they like to take in information and media today is actually to listen to two totally different, very partisan takes on the news, right? I want to know, because these guys are going to uncover everything that cuts to their direction, and these guys will uncover anything that cuts to their direction. That way, I'll be able to kind of take this in and accept it and make some kind of judgment. That's the notion here in this text. However, here's what's different from our system. Right, what's different in our system is the lawyers, at the end of the day, don't wield any of the power. Persuade, I can do what they can procedurally, but at the end of the day, there's no final power other than in the hands of the single judge. And here you have an imagination that what Rabbi Meir's system is aiming to get at is, how could we actually have the power structure of decision-making be fundamentally fed by some very partisan forces that make sure that the sides to the process are fully understood. On this level, it's almost like, for at least those judges, a collapse into the political system. But this is where the third judge plays some kind of a role. The third judge is connected, but nonetheless has enough of a balance that there will not just be a kind of hyper-partisan dynamic. But for Rav Yosef Ibn Migash, The key here is what was not intuitive is that we would have these unilateral selections on each side, and that's what he attempts to explain. Part of the way we get to justice is actually having people in the process who are vigorously pursuing and have the power to pursue those arguments and make them real. Yeah.
So it seems like by the fact that we require there to be three judges in the first place, that we're implying that one judge alone wouldn't be enough to achieve justice. But then it also seems like the first two judges are really more like lawyers. So then aren't we then saying that really one judge is enough because there's really only one impartial judge?
Well, so I think what's so interesting about this approach is it's essentially saying, truth be told, if you thought the only thing Rabbi Meir cared about was that there was balance, then why don't you just have either all three judges selected by both of them? Or for that matter, you could reduce it further. They have to agree on a single judge. And this approach is saying actually a just or a true verdict, as he's reading the Babylonian Talmud, depends on a mix of there being actually some partisan dedication solely to each side, but that actually wields some power on the panel, combined with some kind of intermediate position, right? I don't remember if the National Labor Relations Board works this way. There's a number of federal boards that try to do this. It's like the Democrats get X number of picks, the Republicans get another couple of picks, and then someone gets to break that tie who's at least one step removed. That actually that's going to be what will enable you to play it out. But it's exactly that. It's not reducing it to one of these dynamics or the other. This opinion's understanding of Rabbi Meir and why it is that he proposed this. Okay? Now, let's look at a very different comment. Because if that argues for kind of the full force of the partisanship, here's the problem on the other side. The Rosh in 13th, 14th century German and Spain, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, says the following, and I'll just read this to you. The great picture also of medieval courts and the interaction of Talmudic learning with real life disputes. There are ignorant people who err in understanding Rashi. Remember what Rashi said? Each side will think that their judge pursued every possible argument in their favor. There are ignorant people who err in understanding Rashi and learn from him that a judge should seek arguments in favor of the one who selected him, even to the point of advancing illegitimate arguments to support his cause. Really going hard into the advocacy camp, like what my job is, do anything for my client. Even beyond the canons of what I think is a reasonable argument. Many people have the practice to choose crafty people as judges, and they base themselves on Rashi, God forbid. It's this great scene if you're like in the Middle Ages here, and you have these people who are kind of devious crooks, but they're quoting Rashi as the basis for whom they're appointing to the panel. They imprecisely read what he wrote about each litigant thinking that he has chosen someone who will argue in his favor, and therefore the judgment will be acceptable to both sides. Indeed, the litigant thinks this. The Rosh says, if you want to read Rashi carefully, he's not saying the judges are actually supposed to partisanly pursue the interest of each side, but it's supposed to give the impression to the litigant that that was the case, but God forbid that the judge himself should seek out an argument to support one side if he does not think it is the true law. Yeah, the country will feel good about the people on the Supreme Court, so such a theory would go, because they see Democrats and Republicans both get to pick those people, so they'll feel that it's balanced. But of course, once you're on the court, you're supposed to completely forget about who appointed you or any kind of partisan perspective and just decide what you think the right decision is. If he's able to fool his colleague to accept his argument, even though he himself is not sure about it, then he falls in the category of perverting judgment. Rather, the judge's selection by the litigant means he will truly understand his claims. All you're going for with the selection by the litigant is that you'll have a sympathetic ear to really hear what the grievance is. But as soon as you've done that, you kind of put on your black robe, and you step back, and you are completely detached from whatever went on. Here's the question, right? Can or should grand juries do this, right? Should you take a bunch of people, and juries in general, who you actually try to find, they don't know that much about the case, they don't care that much about the case, you're just going to give them the facts, and that will get us the right outcome, right? Even the Rosh might say perhaps that's a little bit of a problem because people won't feel that it's a jury of their peers. But as long as you've had enough of a sense of, yeah, the jury is kind of representative of different socioeconomic, racial, geographic categories, well, then at that point, though, the job is, in fact, to be sequestered from all of those other kinds of influences. And therefore, you will get, as he puts here at the end, there will be no favorable argument that will be hidden or missed, but the third will listen to the deliberations and judge between them, and thus the true judgment will emerge. All right, this is a very different take, which is pushing the argument much more towards, to use the language from before, some kind of objectivity, as some kind of maybe representative connection to the litigants, but we're not actually trying to create some kind of partisan dynamic in the court. Let's look at last source here. Rav Nissim ben Reuven in 14th century Spain. And here we see, I think, an attempt at a different kind of balance, and I think some very compelling language here for part of what you need to think about a just outcome. Someone want to take us home with this last text, you might say. Please.
You might say, why does Rabbi Meir require both sides to agree only with respect to the third judge? Why not have one side pick all three judges and then have the other side approve them? For the sages, once each side has chosen a judge, there is no more conflict between them because the two judges choose the third. But in Rabbi Meir's case, where the litigants must jointly agree on a third judge, why follow this procedure where each side gets a unilateral choice of one judge? The Talmud explains that this is in order to ensure that judgment will emerge in its true form.
All right, so a very similar question to what we saw earlier in Rabbi Yosef ibn Nigash. Why not just have them agree on all three? What's the point of not having a slate of three which both of them need to approve? Now he's going to play it out, and you'll see his theory of what leads to justice or truth.
If one side chose all three judges, even if the other side later agrees to them, it might be that the judges will still be inclined to the one who honored them with the selection. Alternatively, the other litigant might only agree to these judges out of embarrassment to disqualify them, but will continue to think that the judges will be biased towards the one who selected them. Therefore, we divide this honor between the litigants so that the judgment will not be unbalanced.
Okay, what's the idea there? I do understand what he's saying there. What would be the problem with selecting all three judges at once? What? What's the deficiency? Yeah?
I think, well, he's saying that it might be that one person will really make the decision or have maybe the stronger preference, but others might be out of deference or just fear of kind of speaking out against them.
So, good. And there's actually 2 points there. Let's draw them out. There's no such thing as a joint selection. Two people don't sit at a table and immediately come up in their mind with the exact same name and then blurt it out. Maybe that happens sometimes, but that is very rare. For the most part, what happens is the president nominates and the Senate has to approve. But the person who nominated fundamentally owns that person or is connected to that person in a way that the fact that another party has to not veto them doesn't mean that they actually have the same kind of equal connection. That's the first point of the run, that at the end of the day, right, you're going to potentially produce judges who will be biased more towards one side. Therefore, you need the unilateral selection. But then the other piece, which I think is very important here, goes to the power consideration, is it's a very high bar to actually, when handed a system that asks for your approval, to veto it as opposed to be responsible for its creation. And so the notion that you can simply, with this three judges being selected by one side, say, well, the other side didn't reject them, therefore they both agreed on them, that's actually not creating a dynamic where both sides will feel fully invested. And therefore, you have to divide the honor between them. And I think he captures it beautifully. One side will basically agree, but then they're going to continue to harbor a feeling of, this wasn't really done on my terms. Right? And so the notion of how our various organs of justice are constituted, not just how we approve of them after the fact, becomes another key element of justice. Let me just read you the last paragraph here, which I think gives you another important element, and we'll end with this. Alternatively, perhaps it is just as it sounds. Each judge should vigorously pursue all arguments in favor of his side, and they should wage war. This is his language, yilachamu b'neihem, but with each side conceding true points to the other. God forbid either side should ignore arguments in favor of the other if they seem true. And after this true argument where each side concedes truth to the other, a true judgment will emerge. And if one side will not budge from his opinion, the third judge will break the tie. This to me is actually extremely important. It's very important to me personally. I think one of the things that drives me most crazy about whether it's political debates or certain kinds of judicial processes is when you feel that neither side ever concedes to the other side, that to me is one of the best barometers that something is completely wrong. I don't care if it's from a liberal perspective, from a conservative perspective, it's in the judiciary, if it's in the Congress, wherever it is, when you have somehow managed to emerge with a deliberative or decision-making dynamic where no one ever says, you know what, I thought about what you said, you're right. But you're not yet hearing what I have to say, right? And I need to argue that back to you. If that is completely absent from a process, that is probably a good sign that some degree of injustice is being perpetrated. And while there are a lot of things that I think we are currently dealing with in the American political process and the judicial system of thinking about these issues, I think that's also one of them that often particularly gnaws at people. A notion of getting into a system that is stacked in a certain kind of way or that reduces entirely to the political power that lies behind it, that already feels like something that is not going to be a din emet, it's not going to be a true judgment in some way. So to echo my colleague from this morning, this is not a prescription for a clear policy, but it is an invitation through a number of interesting rabbinic texts to think about how we might more precisely define what it is we mean by justice, what feels like a just outcome, and to the extent that we can identify some of these characteristics, do people feel bought in? Will they sustain the judgment? Is there some kind of vigorous pursuit of the claims of each side? And is there a willingness to actually be open to error? That may perhaps help us have a more transparent discussion of how we get it.